It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is Radio Cycling.
Had enough of sandstorms, palm trees, and camels at the roadside? Get ready then for beers and techno, bergs and burgers. It's time for opening weekend. My name is Jeremy Whittle. Welcome to Radio Cycling. Here's the news. Can anyone beat Visma Lisa Bike's dream team in the wind and rain of opening weekend?
It's really hard races. Most of the strong guys get in the front at the position they deserve at the moment.
Is there light at the end of the tunnel for the Women's Tour of Britain?
It's a pity because this is such a nice race. It's been for a long time probably the best organization in the calendar.
Emotional rescue, how Axel Zinglet saved a fellow pro's life at the GP Marseillaise. So hello everyone, I'm joined by Peter Cossins from the French Pyrenees. That's not actually where he's from, but that's where he is, where half term is starting to feel very long, isn't it, Pete?
It is indeed, Jeremy, but it's nearly there. This is the last day. Hello there.
Nearly over. And also, from a deserted apartment on the Costa Blanca, it's the AI version of Chris Marshall-Bell. Hello, Chris.
Motor doping.
One cycling.
Remco. Motor doping. Remco.
One cycling.
Motor doping.
So maybe I should explain that Chris has, in fact, gone skiing. So, we're finally counting down to the start of the classic season. Opening weekend is just a few short hours away. For old-school fans, it's the true start to the European season. On Saturday, we have the men's and women's editions of Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, with the men returning to action at Kerner-Brussel-Kern on Sunday. Most of the focus going into the weekend has been on the Visma Lisa Bike stellar lineup for Het Nieuwsblad, which features defending champion Dylan van Baarle, 2022 winner Wout van Aert, last year's third-place rider Christophe Laporte, plus Thijs Benoot, Matteo Jorgensen, Eduardo Affini, and the in-form Jan Tratnik. It's quite a lineup, and according to some, this is the most top-heavy team to start this race since BMC lined up in 2012 with Philippe Gilbert, Greg van Avermaet, Alessandro Balan, Tor Hushovd, and Taylor Finney among their eight riders. However, as the results from that year's race underline, a collection of big names doesn't necessarily mean success. BMC didn't even have a rider on the podium that year. Victory went instead to Garmin's Sepp van Marke, and Pete caught up with the Belgian as he prepared to guide Israel Premier Tech's young lions through opening weekend.
Yes, Jeremy, I did. Sepp van Marke retired at the end of last season, and he's now become Israel Premier Tech's lead director for the classics. It's an interesting move, bearing in mind that he's only just retired, but I guess that underlines his qualities in terms of knowing the classics and knowing how to race the classics. That 2012 Het Nieuwsblad success was probably the biggest of his career. He was third there three times as well. He also finished second at Roubaix to Fabian Cancellara, just losing out by 2 centimetres, twice finished third at Flanders, and was twice runner-up at Gent-Wevelgem.
Yeah, so I've been told that Sepp van Marck probably would have won more one-day races if it hadn't been for his wide shoulders, which, given that aerodynamics are so important these days, probably slowed him down. Maybe that's what cost him the 2 centimetre loss to Fabian Cancellara in Paris-Roubaix. Who knows?
That was perhaps it, Jeremy. But anyway, now he's squeezing those shoulders into an Israel Premier Tech team car. And when I spoke to him on Wednesday morning, he was on his way to do some final recons of the Het Nieuwsblad route. And I started by asking him about his team's composition for the weekend.
And I would say we have a younger team. We have a lot of potential. So it's interesting to see where they get. We have some strong older guys who can be in the final, who can show the young guys the road. And we have some young talents who we expect to be there in the future and maybe a few times also this year.
So the question we all want answered was, how do you go about rivaling and beating Visma Lisebike? And Van Marke's answer pointed to what he described as the honest and the dishonest nature of bike racing, as well as to the burden that comes with being the favourites.
Tactics is one thing, but these races are also, they're honest and not honest. They're not honest in a way that you can crash out or get blocked and just not get in a position where you should be and because of this you're chasing. But also on the other hand, they're honest because it's really hard races and let's say most of the strong guys get in the front at the position they deserve at the moment. This team, yeah, Jumbo or Visma is going really strong, like you say. I mean, they have big engines, so it's not easy to beat them. But also with their big engines, they need to use good tactics, and this can also go wrong if the peloton all focuses on them. Then whenever they're gonna go, people want to join, and it's not said that they were gonna win immediately.
Now, Van Marke was a pro for 14 seasons with his focus very much set on the classics. And even though he's in his first season as a DS, he's been given the lead role, as I said, because of this. And he told me it's been having a huge impact on my private life at the moment. That was his quote. Obviously, he's not spending much time at home. He's doing a lot of recons and whatever. And as part of this, he kind of went on to explain that he believes very strongly in the usefulness of recon rides for riders at every level in terms of experience. So for the younger guys, obviously, but also for the older guys on the team. They've got Tom van Aarsbroek on their team, who's been a pro for 12 years. And we got onto this issue because I'd spotted some video posted on Israel Premier Tech socials that showed a rider weaving through thick mud on some cobbles earlier on the week. And it turned out that Sepp had actually shot that footage from the team car during a recon of the Plug Street's cobble section from Gent-Wevelgem, which takes place towards the end of March. And he then went into more detail about this key aspect of racing preparation.
I like to do recons. I always did in the past myself. And now I try to copy it a bit on the riders to do more recons of every classic whenever it's possible, with whoever is possible, because it gives a lot of knowledge to the riders. Now, for example, yesterday I did it with Tom van Aarsbroek. He's already pro for, I don't know, 12 years. But still, because going there and just riding it simple, not the stress of the race, and you can look around. He also said, like, oh, you really understand more the race than in the past. And then I hope to give my experience to them also where to ride, like precise, okay, on this sector, this part you go right, and then this part is better in the middle, and then watch out for these holes. Like, I know all these roads really well, so I try to get more focus on this. I also will try now in the recon tomorrow of opening weekend. To ride with the guys. That's, I think, the first time that DS does this. But yeah, especially for the new young riders, I can help them a lot with being on the road with them and saying a bit how they need to ride these sections.
You're still staying in pretty good shape then, Sepp?
I do, but like on these recons, I'll go with an e-bike. Not for the shape, but first of all, yeah, if they want to go full gas on some climbs, then of course, I need to take it more easy with the heart. And then second, if they want to do kind of motor pacing, I can help them with this also on the e-bike. So it's a bit of a mix, and now it's not about me anymore, it's about them. So I'll take the e-bike, and then I can do every job I have to do.
Now, we've mentioned Visma's Magnificent Seven for Het Nieuwsblad. But Israel's septet look pretty impressive too. They've got experience in the shape of Dylan Teuns and Tom van Aasbroek, who I just mentioned. He won a stage at the recent Tour de Provence. And they've got lots of potential. In Britain, Ethan Vernon, who was a winner at the Tour des Alpes-Maritimes last week. Last year's Paris-Tour winner, Riley Sheehan. And the rider who lit up the 2023 Giro d'Italia, Derek Gee, of course. So what are the prospects for these guys?
Yeah, for sure. For him, for Riley Sheehan, for Ryder Pickrell. Just to name some guys, also Vernon, it's all a learning process, and we're gonna give him like different tasks in different races. Some races he will be helping others, other races we hope he will be in the final and he can race the final. So it's for him and for us getting some experience and to see what he's capable of in these kind of races.
So that was Israel Premier Tech sports director Sepp van Marke. Opening weekend sits between the warm weather desert races in Oman and elsewhere and two of the biggest stage races in the sport, Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico. It also comes a week before the much-loved Strade Bianche. But has that dimmed the appeal of opening weekend in recent seasons? Here's a man who knows the cobbles well, Jayco Alula manager Matt White.
I think opening weekend is just as important as it was a decade ago. I think obviously clashing with UAE takes a couple of the sprinters out of it. But when you have the best sprint field, I think all bar Philipson are in the UAE at the moment. But at the end of the day, those guys are not the guys who feature on especially Saturday. Maybe they might feature Sunday. But it is really the opening. It is still seen as where it really kicks off. The Belgium, and some would agree, the real cycling kicks off this weekend. In Belgium. So yeah, it does have the same importance as it has for the last 10 to 20 years.
Matt, is it as much a testing ground to opening weekend in preparation for the really big races in April?
Yeah, we certainly do. Look, we're obviously going there for a result, but it's the first, and most teams go up a day or two early to check out equipment because, it's the first time since last April you're riding on the fatter tyres, the different combination of air pressure. If there's new technology, you probably have tested it over the weekend, but you're using it in competition for the first time. Obviously, a month out from when it really matters, when you come back for the monuments.
So, obviously, Strade Bianche has become so popular now. Do you think it overshadows opening weekend?
Look, I think Strade Bianche should be a monument. I think they've added 35 kilometres to it this year, which will make it even more selective. But it really is a great classic. It's not on the same weekend, obviously. But yeah, I think there's probably more prestige winning Strade Bianche than winning opening weekend.
Right. And Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico come so soon after opening weekend. Do you think they're a better guide, though, as to who will be on winning form in April when we get to Flanders and Roubaix?
And definitely, I think Paris-Nice and Tirreno is the first real indication of who the favourites are for the month of July. I think all these races in Down Under and the races out in the Middle East, they're good little indicators, even the smaller French races. They're good races, and they're races that teams want to win and target. And we're obviously, for us, it's always an important target Down Under, and Alula Tour now with our co-sponsor being in Saudi, we target that race and won as well. But Paris-Nice and Tirreno are the first of the really good indicators. Obviously, Catalunya has another value and not too many people double up, but it's usually where you get your first big showdowns between the men of July.
That's Matt White. Pete, who else do you think is likely to be in the frame at Het Nieuwsblad?
Well, the field is pretty stacked, Jeremy, so I'll just pick out a few names. There's no Mathieu van der Poel for Alpecin, but as Matt White said there, they've got Jasper Philipsen, who gives them a strong option. After a very disappointing 2023 Classics campaign, Sudal Quickstep will aim to bounce back. They've got Julian Alaphilippe, who's been in the news quite a bit this week, Gianni Moscon, Kasper Asgreen and Yves Lampaert as their cards to play. Groupama FDJ, Stefan Kung has been in good form already, while Ineos go in with Tom Pidcock. Little Trek don't have Mads Pedersen, who's been a multiple winner already this year, so they'll be backing Jasper Stuyven and Jonathan Milan, while Lotto Destiny will get behind Arnaud Delis. And just the final word on the route, just to give you a bit of detail on that, there are 12 classified climbs, 9 cobble sections on the 202-kilometre route. The race will once again climax with what was once the classic Tour of Flanders finale, with the climbs first of the Kapelmuur in Gerardsbergen, the Mur de Grammont, as some people call it, and then the Bosberg before the finish in Ninove.
So most of the big names will be lining up again on Sunday for Kerner Brussels Kern, including Wout van Aert.
Yeah, Kern is not as hilly towards the finish as Het Nieuwsblad is, which is why it tends to favour sprinters like Jasper Philipsen. Most of the climbs are in the middle third of the race. But as Thijs Benoot, a noted non-sprinter, showed last year, it's not always that predictable.
Meanwhile, the women's Omloop Het Nieuwsblad this Saturday is another key rendezvous, particularly for those seeking to hone their form for April's classics. But it also takes an added importance on this year because riders want to get lots of one-day racing in the bank before the Olympic road race this summer. Now, among the protagonists is friend of the pod and former French national champion Audrey Cordon-Ragot, who will be riding in the colours of human-powered health. The Breton rider starts in Omloop and now into double figures, and I caught up with her as she travelled across France to Belgium. Audrey, thank you for joining us. So is Omloop an important race for you, particularly this year because of the Olympics?
I think like it's nothing to see with the Games, as Nieuwsblad always been very important for all the classic riders, and I am a classic rider, so of course the opening weekend is always very important. It's the first time you tackle the cobbles and that you test also your material, your new material on the cobbles. So yeah, it's an important race for everyone, especially now that Nieuwsblad is a World Tour race.
Do you really enjoy these early classics, the cobbles and the bad weather? Is it the kind of racing that really suits you, do you think?
I'm in love with those classics. I've always been the kind of rider who likes the hard conditions, the hard weather. It must be quite bad weather this weekend, which is for me pretty nice, to be honest. I like this kind of situation in the race, and I like cobbles. I'm a heavy cyclist who likes to ride on the cobbles and who has the power to do it.
So on another issue that's been in the news recently, I know the Women's Tour of Britain is a race that you like, that you've ridden in the past. Has the uncertainty about it impacted on your pre-Olympic schedule?
I was not planned on this Tour of Britain, so to me it doesn't change anything. But I guess for some of other riders, it was one of the preparation race for the Olympics. It's a pity because this is such a nice race, and it's been for a long time probably the best organization in the calendar, and it's one of our monument in terms of stage race in women's cycling, and it's a pity that it's not happening. Even if another kind of Tour of Britain coming up with maybe 3 or 4 days race, I don't know if it's kind of the same organization or not, but the Women's Tour was for sure one of my favorite stage race, and it's a pity that it's not happening anymore.
Well, that's Audrey Cordon-Ragot, and hold that thought because we're now joined by Tom Tullis from Cycling Weekly. Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Yeah, fine, thanks, Jeremy. How about yourself?
Good, I'm good. So you've been following progress on British Cycling's attempts to rescue the Women's Tour. Can you update us on the latest?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, as we saw earlier this week, we saw that a four-day event had been added back onto the UCI calendar. I know when we popped up to that briefing in Manchester, that was something that John Dutton all along said was going to potentially be on the cards given the time frame that they're working with. So yeah, as it stands, it would be a 4-day event, and I think from what I gather, a Hubstar race is very much on the cards. I know that he touched on that before as well, and whether that would be maybe one base or potentially two, I think it's all still very much open to several potential options, really. I think the big thing to note is that sponsorship for the race, from what I gather, hasn't been signed off yet. And I think that that would only be the potentially stumbling block that they could encounter along the way. I think there's been an awful lot of promises made in terms of funding, but no contracts actually signed off as of yet. And I mean, that in itself is slightly worrying given the time frame. But I mean, I'm pretty optimistic that they could make something happen. And that's kind of where we're at the moment.
Okay. So when you say a hub race, what can you describe how that would actually work?
Yeah, sure. So, I'm just trying to think of a quick example off the top of my head. I mean, I know the Alula Tour in Saudi Arabia is probably one that comes to mind. And essentially, for people that might not know what that is, that's essentially where the teams, the staff, the journalists that might be following the race, whoever else that may be on board, everyone will fly into one central base and be based out of there for the duration of the event. And essentially the stages would be in and around the local vicinity, but the race HQ and where everything else would be in that centre point, if that makes sense.
I mean, that's something quite a lot of races do now, isn't it? I was just thinking the Tour de Provence does that a bit as well, because they have, like, I think it's four stages and it's largely based kind of around Marseille or Aix-en-Provence or just around there. So everybody stays in one hotel the whole time.
Yeah, exactly that. And yeah, as I say, I'm kind of still just trying to ascertain whether that would be one or two bases. So maybe sort of one base and they do two stages around that area and then move on to the second one. As I say, I don't think that that's kind of fully confirmed either way at the moment. But I must say, in terms of time frame, another important point to note is that something that could also get in the way is, I believe that road closure applications in the UK, they need to be put in significantly far in advance. I mean, we're talking sort of 10 to 12 weeks, anything like that. So, I mean, the longer there's hesitation, shall we say, over getting sponsorship signed off or the kind of logistical arrangements with the race, those road closure applications, that could be a worry for me, actually, and I'm sure it will be for British Cycling as well.
I mean, there's a lot of elements that have to be in place before you can put on a stage race on the open road, as I'm sure if Mick Bennett and Hugh Roberts are listening to this, they're laughing at the kind of, like, yes, of course there are. But I mean, there are lots of obstacles, aren't there? Because there's, you know, are there other events happening? If you go into a city centre, you're limited on the hours. You can have road closures. I mean, my natural instinct is that because this is going to be a British Cycling event, it would have a relationship with Manchester, and then Manchester would probably be the hub, or the Northwest anyway.
Yeah, that's you're absolutely right. I mean, from what I understand, one of the hubs, if they were to go with two options, that would certainly be in the Northwest. From what I gather, actually, with a few chats I had yesterday, it wouldn't necessarily be Manchester, but I think it would certainly be another major location up there. Maybe it would be somewhere in sort of Greater Manchester itself, but not the actual kind of main city. I actually wonder. I know that BC aren't necessarily tied to anything, any sort of agreements that were left over from Sweet Spot, but from Sweet Spot's tenure, shall we say? But I do recall when we were up at that event, listening to John Dutton speak, he sort of touched upon the legacy issues, didn't he, that they'd inherited. And I actually wonder whether they might, well, I don't know whether there'd be anything contractually obliging them to do this, but I wonder if they would look to honour some sort of long-term agreements that other local authorities might have had in the UK with Sweet Spot for these races. So I think that's certainly something that it would be interesting to watch develop in the coming weeks, shall we say.
Right. So that last thing, your gut instinct from the people you've talked to and the impression you're getting, is it a green light or an amber light? Where are we at, do you think? How close is it to being?
Yeah, sure. I would say an amber light, actually. I think, it was positive to see the four-day event go on to the calendar. But I think very much here the issue is funding. As I mentioned, nothing's signed off in terms of sponsorship. So I mean, you have to bear in mind, of course, there's an awful lot of experience there. I mean, John Dutton himself is in kind of had got huge amounts of experience in major sporting events and organisation around that, as has countless other people at BC. But I think the big thing here is funding. Like, all of that experience is all very well, but if there's not the funding there to back up any plans that they want to put in place, then that's going to be the issue. I'd say very much an amber light for now. And just sort of a final point really would be, I think, of course, if for whatever reason, and it's a big if, that the race doesn't happen, the women's tour, I think it certainly won't be for lack of effort in any way whatsoever. I think very much, I'd say to cycling fans in the UK, they very much need to be patient with British cycling on this one. If the race doesn't happen this year, I think they'll go absolutely all out to make it happen next year.
Tom, thank you so much for joining us. See you soon.
Thanks. See ya.
So finally, we turn to a quite astonishing story. It's a tale that could have had an absolutely awful outcome, but which ended up with a leading pro perhaps saving the life of one of his close friends during a race in France last month. Pete, you've been looking into this story.
Yeah, Jeremy, this all happened at last month's GP Marseillaise. It's the opening race of the French season. And in that race, the riders were descending from the Route de Crête when several riders crashed on a dangerous bend. And including those that went down was Yael Joyond of the CIC Unant Atlantique team. He rode face first into a wall and was knocked unconscious. And that was how co-fatigued Axel Zangler found him after going down in the same incident. Now, Zangler told Direct Velo's Nicolas Mébile what happened next.
After the crash, it took me a while to come to my senses, but when I saw Yael, I thought he was done for. He didn't look to be conscious and he was starting to convulse. He was on his back and his mouth was full of blood. I could see he couldn't breathe. I realised that he'd hit his head hard. I was really scared for him. He could have been killed. I tried to stay with him until someone more competent arrived. Mentally, it really wasn't easy, especially as he's a friend, even though I would have been just as shocked by the situation for any other rider in the peloton. Crashes happen all the time, but this was a serious one.
Now, Nicolas Mébile, as I mentioned, who's on Direct Velo, a website that's well worth following, he spoke to Yael Joyond, still in considerable pain from his hospital bed in Valoris, which is close to Cannes on the Côte d'Azur, and he gave his side of the story.
I have no memory of the fall or the moments that followed. The last image I have on my hard drive is the summit of the Crête. Then I woke up in hospital in Marseille. But I know what Axel did for me. It was a good thing he was there. He may well have saved my life. Now, Joyon's injuries are substantial. He's got 10 fractures in his face, sinuses, nasal septum and jaw. He's had plates and screws put in his chin. 4 of his vertebrae were also effective, one of which was shattered and is still not stable. He spent the 4 weeks since the crash laid out in bed, losing 5 kilos in the process, as he can only take in compotes, yogurts and purees because his jaw is so smashed. He admitted that he hopes to get back on the bike one day, but is still a long way from knowing whether he'll be able to reach his previous level. For the time being, he said, going home would already be a great victory. I can't wait to get home to see my girlfriend and my dog. I hope to get back on the bike as soon as possible too, but I can't afford to miss any of the stages. I'm not going to play the fool and then be paralysed in 30 years' time or have a bad back.
Well, as cycling again debates safety and stakeholders continue to plead for safer racing, that's a very sobering tale, and our best wishes to him for a speedy recovery. Well, that's about it for this show. Thanks to Pete and our producers Will and Will, and of course to our guests Sepp van Marker, Matt White, Audrey Cordon-Rego and Tom Toulis from Cycling Weekly. Say goodbye, Pete.
Goodbye, Jeremy.
Say goodbye, Chris.
Motodoping, Remco.
One Cycling,
Remco, Motodoping.
That's enough of that. Thanks as ever for listening. See you next time.
Social Podcast Network.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.